Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Woo, welcome back. Hope everyone had a great weekend. American. This is Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, along with my handsome, debonair, and oh-so-intellectual co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Good afternoon, and it is great to be here on this March 12th, Tuesday, another exciting edition of Southern Sense, of another dedication, and of course, Mr. Brad is our guest today, so I'm ready to rock and roll.
Yeah, we got Brad Marston, who'll be calling in at quarter after the hour. But I got a couple of things I promised I would talk about just before we do the dedication. Our friend Emery McLennan, who's been, you know, caller in on the show a few times. He's also with the
Fort Wayne
Tea Party, and he's got an organization called ARMAD, ARMAD.net, and they've got their annual Military Appreciation Day. It's a ham radio appreciation where around the world people can speak to troops via ham radio. And he's going to be having that at the Parkview North Family Park on Parkview Plaza Drive in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And this is May 25th. So if you want more information, it's www.armad.net. And then for us here in Beaufort, South Carolina, it's official. Lieutenant Dan Week is coming back, week number 4. I posted in the chat room the link to that, which is ldw4.org. So we're going to be reaching out to Gary Sinise to get him to come back on and talk about Lieutenant Dan Band Weekend and the Independence Fund that helps these wounded veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. So we got ourselves a lot of rocking time here.
Yeah, just before we do the dedication, Gary Sinise was on EWTN, which is a Catholic network, and he was talking about how he does the Lieutenant Dan tour. He actually singled out your city and talked about how it's become like almost a weekly event, with the weekend being the grand finale. I think that's obviously terrific that he would actually single out your area. That's kind of neat. And you think, wow, he was on our show. Just the great things they do for veterans. And just so for the record, Annie, on this year, on May 25th, I am not going to miss Emory's. The last two years, as you know, weather has been a problem, and then I don't know, something else came up, but I'm going to go down early.
Was it last year, the year before you called me? You were actually in a travel stop because it had rained so hard. You were curling up inside your car to take a nap because you just could not even see 5 feet in front of you.
Yeah, and I was actually an hour away. My brother lives 45 minutes from there, so I'm going to go down on Monday. I'm going to do the show Friday with you from there, and then I'm going to head up early. That was 2 years ago, and I didn't say anything to anyone. You and I knew, but we were going to surprise Emory, and it's going to be a big surprise. But this year, we'll have him on, and I'll say, like, oh, I wish I could be there. I have this to do. And out of nowhere, we'll surprise him. But anyway, on with our dedication.
All right. This goes out to an Army captain, Captain Matthew G. Nelson, who is killed serving our nation in Operation New Dawn, June 29th, 2011. So we need the Army mix, Mike.
It's playing as we speak, Annie.
Okay. From Jefferson, Iowa. Hundreds of people streamed into a community center to pay respects to a capable and caring soldier who was everything you would expect a Jefferson, Iowa kid to be. U.S. Army Captain Matthew Nielsen was a young man clearly rooted deep in his values, said Major General Will Grimsley at the funeral service at the Greene County Community Center in the 27-year-old's hometown. Grimsley said Nielsen was a natural leader. His men followed him because he led by example. They respected him, he said. Nielsen died June 29, 2011, from wounds sustained in Badra, Iraq. Reverend Stafford Oond of Zion Lutheran Church in Ogden, another town where Nielsen lived, emphasized Nielsen's beliefs. We go back to the basis of his life. The basis of his life was his faith, Oond said. We said it was difficult to live when loved ones are taken, but that God is merciful and has a steadfast love. God will continue to strengthen and encourage you, he said. Nielsen's parents, Roger and Christine, and his seven siblings shared the memories of the soldier at his funeral. A sister, Kristen, 15, said that her brother was strong and was a leader. We used to chat on Facebook when he was in Iraq. We talked about what he was going to do when he got home, she said. He said he wanted to visit our sister in Colorado and get his Jeep that was in Texas. Matthew Nielsen was homeschooled with his siblings by his mother. He attended the University of Iowa. He graduated with honors in May of 2008 and was commissioned as an officer in the U.S. Army. Dave Abram, a retired chaplain from the Iowa Army National Guard, said Kristen Nielsen taught her son faith, gave him an education, and modeled sacrifice, honor, and duty for him. I would call you a command sergeant major, Abram said to her. The sidewalk and entrance to the community center were lined with American flags. National Guard soldiers carried Nielsen's casket, draped in red, white, and blue, into the gym, which filled with stars and stripes. After the service, Nielsen was buried in the Iowa Veterans Cemetery near Van Meter. Jason Gallardo, who was Nielsen's troop commander for 18 months, he said the fallen soldier was the kind of man who would give anything for his friends. He was the most genuine, downright sweet guy. He was the officer we all wanted to be. He was the best of us. He concluded by addressing the fallen soldier. Matthew, you are the type of man who makes us proud to do this service. You will be missed. And he is. To Matthew and to all the men and women who serve, we honor them and dedicate each show. And we dedicate the song, My Name is.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. My strength was not taken from others. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames.
My name is America. And you know what, Mike? I came across, I realized I had a second autographed copy of that DVD and want to be putting it up for a contest real soon. And all right, GOP Gopher was asking if today was the Congress people that we're going to be having up. They're running here in South Carolina. No, that is on Friday the 15th because the primary is on the following Tuesday. So we're going to have them on Friday just before everyone goes for the weekend. Today's guest.
Yep.
We have,
and that was a great dedication to Army Captain Matthew G. Nelson. Oh, man, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a big, next to Notre Dame, I'm a big Iowa Hawkeyes fan, so when you said he went to the University of Iowa. But, as always, every show is dedicated in memory of our fallen soldier. May he and his family, may he rest in peace, and may his prayers be with his family. Go ahead, Ann.
All right, we've got a great guest today. His name is Brad Marston. He's got an organization called Four Tier Strategies. He's also been an entrepreneur, a restaurateur, a man of all trades, an actor, a singer, and probably chief cook and bottle washer. Good afternoon, Brad.
Annie, great to be here. Mike, thank you both for having me on.
Thank you, Professor.
And Brad, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, because I was reading your bio, and what haven't you done?
Well, I think it's more I'm looking for something that I'm finally good at. I went to Georgetown University. I was a double major, philosophy and economics. I couldn't decide if I wanted to be a philosophical economist or an economical philosopher, so I became a bond trader on Wall Street and did that for 12, 13 years. And then I realized I just sort of got burnt out on it. People had a tendency to measure their self-worth by their net worth. And I was lying on a beach wondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I'd always been a pretty good singer, and I decided I didn't want to wake up in 10 or 20 years wondering if I was good enough. So I flew back to New York and started studying and started auditioning, and I worked for 4 or 5 years, never particularly successful. So I found out I was good. I just wasn't quite good enough. And then, like a lot of people working in acting in New York, you gravitate often to the restaurant business, which allows you flexibility for auditions or if you get in a show, that sort of thing. And I found I really enjoyed restaurant management. Managing a really diverse group of people, certainly most of whom have backgrounds much different than my own. And then I actually helped organize the first Boston Tax Day Tea Party back in 2009, and was given asked to give a talk about what's next, where do we go from here. And that got me thinking, and I woke up one morning, called my regional VP and said, you can consider this my 2-week notice. And then realized that the incumbent state rep here I live in Boston and downtown Boston. She hadn't had a challenger basically since she was elected. Then it would have been six years prior. And so I decided to run for state rep as a Republican in what is arguably the worst district for a Republican in all of Massachusetts. It's Back Bay, Beacon Hill, and just to make it sporty, five precincts in the People's Republic of Cambridge. And I
lived up there 2 years.
Okay, so you know what I mean.
You ran against Martha, the what's her name, that painted, Martha, whatever her name was, correct?
Marty Walls, and
yeah,
as my business partner John LaRosa quipped on Twitter, that Marty Walls is Martha Coakley minus the charisma. And I didn't win, but I was very proud when I saw her final campaign finance report for the election cycle that she had spent $90,000 to beat me. And that's $1,000 that couldn't go to other state rep races or the gubernatorial race, that sort of thing. So we gave her a good run for the money, and I learned a lot about really boost. I had been involved in the McCain campaign back in 2008, primarily on the online side, just because the only reason a Republican candidate for president comes to Massachusetts is to either pick up donor checks or their flight to Manchester, New Hampshire gets diverted. So I did a lot of online stuff. And then after the election, John LaRosa, my business partner, he and I sat down, and we were just amazed during the course of the campaign I was getting calls from congressional candidates in August saying, what should I do next? And it's like, well, what does it say in your campaign plan? And they'd say, do you really think I need one? You know, that kind of thing. So John and I launched Four-Tier Strategies in, January of 2011, thinking we were going to be advising state reps, state Senate candidates, and no, lo and behold, Our first candidate, first client straight out of the box was Herman Cain for president. So I guess that's kind of a long-winded explanation of my background, but there it is.
Were you responsible for that cigar commercial?
I would. The smoking man, Mark
yeah.
Block. I was not. I helped write the scripts for some of his videos, but that one was the brainchild of Mark and the filmmaker that did all of Mr. Cain's commercials.
Because I loved it the first time I saw it.
Yeah, and what was funny was people were, and we were involved in pushing it. We did a lot of the Cain campaign social media. And, you know, people to this day, people ask me about it. And, you know, what were you thinking and all this kind of stuff. And it's like it got 2 million views. And for a week, the only thing anybody was talking about in the media and in social media was Herman Cain. It did exactly what we wanted it to do.
That first debate really put him on the map. I think everybody was surprised, which is going to lead me to my next question. Just first a comment. The lady you ran against in Boston, every time her face is on the tube, what a pro-choice woman she is. Just sick, makes me sick. I was watching some of the videos and studying for the show. Oh, man. That's Massachusetts for you. But you know what? Somebody's got to run against those people. Go ahead.
Right. Well, and interestingly enough, she has just resigned from the as a state rep because she's now the president of NARAL Pro Choice Massachusetts.
Good God!
No, I looked up there, and I worked in downtown Boston for American Express, right at Government Center, and then I left there to go up to Reading to manage one of their offices. As a New Yorker living there, it was bad enough being a New Yorker and a Republican. But being a New Yorker and a Republican in Boston, oh, man, you were like blacklisted wherever you went.
I'm going to make a statement, Brad, and I'd like you to comment on it. I think the Republican Party, after finding out that Herm Cain was not your traditional I'll play ball with the GOP politics, I think he was smeared and blackballed by the party itself. I'll let you comment on that.
Ooh, let me see what I can say.
Clearly, Herman Cain was not your typical GOPer. I got the impression off him you could not buy Herman Cain. I liked him a lot.
Yeah, I did too. I had actually known Mr. Cain from when I was in the restaurant industry, and he was head of the National Restaurant Association. That's the NRA that everybody doesn't vilify. I'm going to say that the source of the information, the source of the rumors, etc., came from the Republican side and not the Democrats. They took him down. They saw, his power of public speaking. When he won the Florida, was it I-5 straw poll?
It was a straw poll, yes.
He did that with one staffer on the ground. And at that time, the Cain campaign was so short of money, they couldn't even afford the $7,000 or $10,000 for the list of all the Republicans and the precinct, county leaders, et cetera, et cetera. And Jamie Brazil went down to Florida by himself and started making phone calls. And once he got somebody to, once he got somebody to sign on, made them a precinct captain, then it was their responsibility to then go out. So it was all grassroots. And that the grassroots power that was behind Herman Cain, I think, actually did scare the Republican establishment.
They're still scared. They are still scared. You're looking at the budget debate, and they're all running for the hills as the conservatives are saying, no, we've got to stand our ground. It's driving me crazy, this wishy-wash. Now, is this Obama's intention to deliberately divide and splinter the Republican Party?
Well, I think so, and he's certainly getting plenty of help from our side. Both he and Harry Reid have played the last 4-plus years really brilliantly from a political point of view. I mean, the only thing Harry Reid allows to come to a vote are either bills that he knows are going to pass or bills that he knows can't pass, but knows that it will embarrass Republicans for having to vote against them. And if it does vote, they'll still politically be able to use their votes. Perfect example, certainly not a conservative, but Scott Brown, he voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act and got vilified for it in the press and in the social media up here by those on the left. But the Paycheck Fairness Act was, in fact, the Plaintiff Lawyer Enrichment Act. Dodd-Frank, which I think Scott did eventually vote for, but a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives didn't, not because they want a repeat of the financial collapse, but because it was a lousy bill that doesn't have the effect of doing anything about banks becoming too big to fail. It doesn't touch Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie and Freddie are not the total cause of the financial collapse, but they certainly get honorable mention.
Wow. Now, I had to print this out because the other day you were up on Facebook, and that's how I met you, through Twitter and Facebook. We've been going back and forth, I think, since about 2009 when I started my Tea Party down here. And you wrote something that just had me laughing. You said, "I know I have to keep up on the sequester debate, but I want to watch another Obama speech like I want to watch a Michael Moore, Chris Christie gay porn video. This is why I love you." You just put it in complete perspective.
Well, I do try and use humor. It's something that John LaRosa has really sort of taught me and pushed me towards to get your point across, because if you're constantly making, dry technical points about politics, policy, et cetera, it just sort of, it's like watching a Charlie Brown video when the adults are talking and it's wah, 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 wah. Using humor, one of the things that we try and coach our political clients on, especially in social media, is don't forget the social part. Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House, famously said all politics is local. Well, no, with social media now, all politics is personal. And you're not going to go out and try and create a personal relationship with 100,000 or 1 million or 10 million voters. You go out and create a personal relationship with one voter, and then repeat that process 100,000 or 1 million times. And, yes, I use humor to make point, analogies, that kind of thing. And since we are Facebook friends, apparently it works.
Well, actually, you turned me on yesterday to this Rebel Mouse. I never heard about it, and I started poking around on it. And now, because of you, I've got a Rebel Mouse presence.
I saw that. It's an interesting platform, and for listeners who aren't familiar, it's basically a social media aggregator that presents all of your social media streams in a single website, whether it's Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, etc. I do spend a lot of time looking at sites like that, social media services, do a lot of reading on you know, basically internet marketing, because in essence, every campaign is a new business startup, and every candidate, especially a first-time candidate, is sort of the ultimate new product launch. The one thing, but the other thing about social media that's so important is it's not about, if you want to be successful in social media and political social media, it's not always about getting your message out, but rather making sure people feel they can get their message in. And the problem I have, or what I haven't figured out yet about Rebel Mouse, is how to pull in other people's feeds, because I already know what I know. What I'm interested in is learning what other people know.
Yeah, I was looking at that, and I wish that you'd be able to make your homepage a little bit more custom, where you could add some freeform text or something. And it's in a beta stage right now, but I do see this thing surpassing probably Twitter, Facebook, and everything else.
Well, it could.
You got those fighters overhead there, Annie.
Oh, no, that's on Brad's side, not me.
Oh.
Yeah, because I live in the heart of the Tri-Command here in South Carolina. You got the Marine Corps Air Station in Buford, you got the Parris Island Recruit Depot, and then you've got the Buford Naval Hospital. So we're right smack on the Tri-Command. So every now and then, we got an F-16 coming overhead, soon to be the F-35s, if they ever get off the ground.
I have a question for you, Brad, and this is kind of a criticism of our party, well, being Republican primarily. I think we're all good Americans, but we vote Republican. Whatever happened in the Republican Party of loving business competition and everything, as far as you have Herm Cain, who was a good candidate, great. Let's have 1,000 great candidates. Let's have them all slug it out. Whatever happened to that, considering obviously they saw him as a threat and a way to get rid of a potential person who clearly his momentum after Florida was on fire. It probably, I haven't seen something like that since Pat Buchanan defeated Bob Dole in New Hampshire in the mid-90s. So,
right.
I mean, whatever happened, it seems like our party's becoming more of a country club-only type mentality, whereas basically we're not even servers or cooks, we're more like janitors.
Well, I think, Mike, that's why you're seeing the, for lack of better term, the Tea Party wing, the activist wing of the Republican Party, really starting to stand up to the sort of entrenched leadership. I mean, and I find it an interesting dichotomy, because I'm a member of the Greater Boston Tea Party, one of the founding members. I'm also Boston Republican Ward 5 chairman, and I'm also treasurer of the Boston Republican City Committee. So I sort of straddle both those worlds. And, you know, unfortunately, the Republicans, we just have a tendency of going, you know, well, you know, it's who did the best last time gets to run this time. So Romney wasn't successful in 2008, but he came in second. And unfortunately, that puts our candidates in the position of basically campaigning on, well, I sucked less than I did 4 years ago. Regardless of who it is, you know, I mean, 2 weeks ago, it was Dr. Ben Carson that everybody, you know, was like, Ben Carson for president. And then with Rand Paul's wonderful filibuster, now everybody's exploding, you know, Rand Paul for president. And I think that type of activism is really a good thing. One of the things I like about Rand Paul is he clearly believes his own story. He clearly has his convictions and is willing to stand up for principle. Ben Carson, same thing. I think one of the reasons that Mitt Romney's campaign never took off. One, he never made the moral argument for free markets, capitalism, and liberty. And two, he didn't even believe his own story. I mean, Bill Whittle had that great video where, you know, he sort of says what Mitt Romney should have said. And one of the things is, no, Ms. Crowley, I'm not worth $200 million. I'm worth $250 million. Thank you very much. I worked hard for it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant rant by Bill Whittle. And if you haven't seen it, I would definitely search for it on YouTube.
It's almost as if they're apologizing for being successful instead of saying, hey, no, I earned this from the sweat of my brow, from the blood of my veins. I earned every single step of it, and the government did not help me one iota.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and you probably, you know, anybody who followed Massachusetts politics at all, it was probably the highest profile race with Scott Brown running against Elizabeth Warren. And she famously made the "You Didn't Build That" video, and saying, you know, you didn't build the roads that your goods go to market on, and you didn't educate your workforce, and you didn't hire private security to protect your buildings. We did that. The government did that. And no one ever pushed back, saying, well, wait a second, unless everybody in the room that you're speaking to is a teacher, a construction worker, or a policeman, you didn't build it. And it's like, oh, well, no, well, the people, you know, we, the people. It's like, okay, well, where did they get the money from? It's like, well, where did government get the money from? Well, from our taxes. Okay, and where did your taxes come from? Well, from the wages we earned working for businesses. Aha, thank you.
But they never even take it one step further, saying that road would not be necessary if someone didn't have the forethought to build a business or build a farm or build a town where it required a road to go to. Unless someone thought of something innovative that caused you to go in that direction, you wouldn't have to have additional teachers and firefighters and police and roads. You wouldn't need all that infrastructure unless businesses and people were there that already built something.
Right. Too many people fail to see that or understand that government can't do anything, doesn't have money or resources to spend other than what it has already taken out of the private economy and or borrowing from the future. I'll leave it there. My other thought just sort of passed through the station.
Oh, man. I came across something with the lie of the year. This was in the Hollywood Republican. And Obama was talking about that they lost 3.6 million votes. Obama was not talking about that. He was not mentioning it. He's got this thing where he's won hands down. He has a mandate. But they don't talk about he lost 3.6 million votes while Republicans gained 1 million. Just 2% swing, Romney would be sitting in the presidency. So where does the mandate come from?
Oh, well, the mandate comes from how the victory is portrayed in the mainstream media. You know, I always love when liberals say, you know, Citizens United is horrible and we have to repeal it. And, you know, we shouldn't have corporations, helping to decide our elections. It's like, well, last time I checked, CNN was a corporation. The New York Times, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, et cetera, are all corporations. And why should those kinds of corporations have a voice in our electoral process, but AT&T, Apple, Exxon, you know, whomever, not have a voice? I mean, you just look at the way Mitt Romney's, you know, corporations are people, and I don't think that's the exact phrase he used, how that was played up in the media, when his point was clearly that corporations are made up of people.
That's a little-known fact, that corporations are made up of people. I was looking for one of the articles that was attached to this, and I don't know what I did with it, but talking about the election, and everyone was saying there was no voter fraud, no voter fraud, no, nothing happened. They just arrested a woman who voted 8 times in the last presidential election. And where's the media on this? Well, along with everything else.
I bet she didn't vote for Romney.
You know, they're ignoring Fast and Furious. They're ignoring Benghazi. They're ignoring the voter fraud. They even came up with posters that were put out by the Obama camp that had racial and Nazi referrals on them. No one's talking about this.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it's all across the country. There's the show ID to vote, and you know, push, and you know, and people say, you know, there are no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Well, that's because nobody has looked, and then we found out the Governor Patrick administration decided to settle a lawsuit that charged that Massachusetts wasn't doing enough to sign register voters when they came in for public various things of public assistance. And so, oddly enough, just before the deadline for registration, the Department of Health and Human Services up here sent out at taxpayer expense 475,000 voter registration cards to people on public assistance. It was a little embarrassing when 29,000 of them came back as, you know, not deliverable. So we don't even know where 29,000 public assistance recipients are, and we don't know where 29,000 potential voters are. You know, hey, you want an ID to vote, you know, and they say, you know, well, showing a voter ID would disproportionately hurt the poor. Okay, great. Make EBT cards with photographs on them, which one would cut down on the fraud, because in Massachusetts you can take your EBT card and use it in an ATM machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And
wow.
And then
that's a
you
crock of
could
shit.
Oh,
you can get
God,
cash with it.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, they even do that here in South Carolina, I believe. They got caught in New Jersey in Atlantic City gambling off of the food stamp cards.
Buying groceries when you can get cash? Every time that, you know, reloads, first place they're going to head is the ATM for the dough.
Absolutely. You've got 29,000 people that are receiving public assistance they can't locate. So what happens to all of that money, that public assistance? Are they going to cut it off? I doubt it. Are they still continuing to pay it out? That's 29,000 times how many thousands of dollars per month per person?
I'm not sure, but I think off the top of my head, I think in the latest report, they estimated that it was a total of somewhere between $25 and $35 million a year that's either given out fraudulently or that they can't really verify that the people need it, etc.
Just an example of when, you know, there's always that debate of you need ID and what's wrong with it. Just an example of how we use our ID and other places are making us use our ID. I asked to use a restroom at a gas station where the restaurant was on the side of the building. They give you the key in exchange for your license, and when you return the key to the restroom back, they hand you back your license. So, I mean, any kind of...
ID to pee.
How in the hell can it be such a violation? You know, I think saying hello after hello, everything's politically incorrect. How in the world are you going to know that the person is John or Jane Doe if they don't hand you an ID that says you're John or Jane Doe? Hey, maybe they don't want to know if you're John or Jane Doe.
Some of the stories out of Worcester, Massachusetts, of, you know, just sort of, you know, people showing up in waves, and I mean, a bus, you know, suddenly appears, and you know, being coached on how to vote. I mean, the Democratic Party doesn't want show ID to vote because they know it would cut down on fraudulent voting and marginal voting. The same way they want to overturn Citizen United because the corporations that they like, i.e. the mainstream media corporations, would still be able to affect elections. It's just corporations they don't necessarily like wouldn't.
It's a whole thing of smoke and mirrors, basically. And my husband was stationed in Worcester, Massachusetts, at the Marine Corps recruiting station there. They have a reserve unit over there that he was sent up to as a Navy sergeant. I know the area. I know exactly the area you're talking about. But you're talking about lessons and everything. They're already bringing up names of Republicans to run for president. And they come up as front runners, and I'm sorry, I have to pull out the barf bag on this one. Chris Christie and Jeb Bush. And then Jeb Bush on George Stephanopoulos, George Stephanopoulos, said Jeb Bush told him, I'm in sync with Lindsey Graham on immigration reform. Can you get any more rhino than those three names?
Well, it's pretty tough. You know, I think they're too often we make a mistake of miscommunicating the difference between a rhino and a moderate. And you know, we're not a big enough party that we can really sort of push anybody out of the tent. But having Chris Christie or Jeb Bush, you know, as sort of the front runner, I feel the same way you do. You know, I used to be a big John McCain supporter, worked on it, you know, worked on his campaign up in New Hampshire and online, traveled with him. But, you know, I've sort of had it. You know, I used to work in the restaurant business, and, you know, we actually, I think, did a better job than most in trying to confirm people's, immigration status. But if you do too much, you can actually be attacked by sued, come after by the government for discrimination if you try and look too closely. And, everybody says, oh, well, our immigration system is broken. Well, we actually allow in about a million and a half immigrants, legal immigrants, a year. It's not really our fault that 30 or 40 times that many want to come here. And, you know, and then they say, well, we need a path to citizenship. I said, well, why not just why not just a path to being legal? You know, you can become a permanent resident, but you can't become a citizen because you came here illegally, and you can't vote. And
should not get government benefits or social welfare from either state or federal.
So, I mean, remember the old days, you had to have a sponsor who would, you know, be financially responsible for at least 5 years. And then, you know, the other thing is that the left always likes to talk about fairness. You know, we've got to make a level playing field. Well, where's the fairness in letting 12 to 20 million people jump ahead of the line of people who are trying to follow the rules and come here legally? And people say, oh, well, no, they would go to the back of the line behind anybody who's here, you know, here on a visa with a green card, et cetera. I said, wait a second. The line starts in their countries. There are millions of people that can't get through the immigration process to even get here. So I'm sorry. I don't have a problem with truly being fair and saying, yeah, if you want to apply for citizen, you know, you can become legal, pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera. But if you want to become a citizen, that line starts back in your country. Or as I like to say, there is a path to citizenship. All you have to do is turn your sorry ass around and go back towards the country you originally came from, where you're a citizen.
And then that way you say to the ones that have the kids that came here without the, you know, any say in the matter.
Okay, now I want to follow up on something. Oh, sorry, Annie. I want to follow up something. Okay, Brad, what you just said was very politically incorrect. However, why isn't more people from our party saying that? I mean, it does.
Yeah.
Get back there. I mean, we've just got a bunch of pussies on our team now. They're just so politically correct. It is. It's more concerned about getting maybe a person who the chances are zero that these people will ever support conservative candidates. So why even try? I mean, it's just so frustrating dealing with these idiots.
Yeah, because someone asked me, what do you do about the kids? Well, if mommy and daddy took the time to bring that child over, mommy and daddy can take the time to bring that child back and let them re-enter legally. That's it.
Yeah,
they stay with mommy and daddy.
Yeah, Mike, you know, don't hold back. Tell us how you really feel.
no problem, Brad.
I mean, you do have the problem. Legally, I mean, if they are born here in the United States, they're U.S. citizens. And I think in part answer to your question, Mike, you know, just like in war, you're always fighting the last battle. And we're always fighting. It seems we're always fighting the last election or contesting the last election. And I think the fact that we did so badly with Hispanics, Asians, et cetera, has the party concerned. And so everybody's trying to come up with a message of, well, let's not offend anybody. I mean, Annie, you may have seen, you know, I put up on my Facebook wall, you know, everybody is given a gift. Mine happens to be pissing people off. and no, you can't go out with a message intended to make other people upset, but let's go out with a positive message, a message of growth, message of opportunity, a message that, okay, we acknowledge that these people are here illegally and will have a path to legality, but not a path to citizenship. And here's why. And, you know, and I would even go so far, if it meant truly securing our borders, and just so everybody understands, securing your borders means securing your airports and your ports as well. People have to remember that 40% of illegal immigrants in this country come primarily from Europe, et cetera, and simply overstay their visas. So I don't want to be cast as a racist because I think that having borders is probably important, or secure borders is probably important if you want to be a country. But I would, if all of those things would happen, I would be willing to go with, okay, you're here legally. We know where you are. We know you're working. We know you're paying taxes. And if you want to go home and then apply for citizenship and then come back and work here and pay your taxes, contribute to your community while the citizenship process takes place, that's fine.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. You know, if they are here legally and then you want to give them a path for them to legally stay, a legal resident, they can never become a citizen unless they return home and come back through the proper process.
Correct.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Absolutely agree with that.
You know, and that's it. I mean, we just need to be more steadfast. George W. Bush, who I cannot stand. I mean, he went bent over backwards with the idea, that fantasy, that by bending rules, we're going to get this large influx of Hispanic votes in line. I mean, it just, you know, if it starts illegal, it's illegal. I mean,
well,
it's just that simple.
Right, and that's why we have to, I mean, one of the things you have to do is, one, use liberal tactics against them, and then you have to, I remember I was given the unenviable task of defending a budget or a ballot proposal here to roll the sales tax back from 5.25% to, or 6.25% to 3%. And this really obnoxious liberal woman, and I was speaking at the Ward 5 Democratic Committee. And for people who don't know, currently Massachusetts has four, or at the time we had 5 of 40 senators were Republican and 16 of 160 state representatives were Republican. And this woman says, Mr. Marston, you and your party, the party of no. And I just said, Karen, with 5 senators and 16 state reps, we're barely the party of excuse me, much less the party of no.
Well, not to mention, if you think about it, when recently have the Republicans really said no? I mean, we're saying yes as often as the Democrats. It's almost it almost makes, I'll tell you, people are lucky drug hard narcotics aren't legal, because I'd be taking them all the time the way our party's gone. You know, we used to be so prideful in the true fiscal cash conservative, like what Professor Limbaugh teaches. I mean, now it's almost like we're today, tomorrow, and the next day, you don't know what's going to come out of our mouth.
Well, I mean, on the budget side, I love the fact that John Boehner, Mitch McConnell have said, no, you got your tax increases. And listen, back in November, December, purely from a political point of view, I think we should have gone with President Obama's proposal to raise taxes on anybody making over $250,000 a year, just so that we could turn around, because I knew that the debt ceiling was coming up and appropriations was coming up, so that we could simply say, we gave you exactly what you wanted. We gave you the taxes you asked for. We're done. And I think people are recognizing that we did give on taxes. I mean, it was an unwinnable battle, because by doing nothing, taxes were going to go up on everybody. But Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, Paul Ryan have all said, we did tax increases. Now we're going to start talking spending cuts. And the fact that Paul Ryan has brought out his budget, you know, and pointing out the Senate hasn't passed a budget in 1,400 days, and President Obama is constitutionally required to, or at least legally required, to issue his budget proposal on the first Monday of February. Well, it's now the second Tuesday of March, and we're still waiting. And this is the fourth out of 5 times that he's missed that deadline. So, again, it's like positive, pro-growth, pro-opportunity, strong message. Hey, we're doing our, you know, Republicans in the House are doing their jobs. So stop blaming us for the fiscal problems. And if you look at I think it was the McClatchy-Maris poll came out today or yesterday, and President Obama's popularity ratings have dropped from 53 to 45, and it's basically now neck and neck on who people think is best able to handle our budget problems. You know, and whereas 2 months ago, there was a 20 point edge in favor of Obama and the Democrats over the Republican House.
Yeah, I was up on Facebook and Twitter the other day, and I was blasting Lindsey Graham and McCain. I think you caught a couple of them, because here are these senators.
Yeah, a couple of them left the mark.
Here are these two senators. It was a total of 16 senators that show up at the White House for this dinner. At the very same time, Obama turns around and says he cannot keep the White House open, the People's House, for tours for the kids, school kids. Now, he's a guest in the home. This is the People's House. So these 16 senators, which, of course, just not only the food, but the overtime of the staff there, the cooking, the cleaning, the Secret Service, the whole nine yards, the decorations, and the entertainment, because you know they're not going to be eating McDonald's hamburgers off the $1 menu. But they'll have this lavish thing to talk about the budget, which produced zero, absolutely nothing. And then now, reading in the Mail, the British paper, the Mail, that Michelle is going to turn 50, and now she's going to have a really huge bash at the White House. Again, staff and Secret Service and all the other things that come with it at the taxpayers' dollars for her 50th birthday, but they won't open it for school children. Meanwhile, Obama now goes to Florida for $1 million, plays with Tiger Woods, but for $74,000 a month or a week, he can't keep the White House open. Can anyone tell me where the sanity in this is?
Well, one thing for certain, Brad, you and I won't see any invitations to her birthday party.
No, I actually have been to the White House as a guest once when my dad was in the Ford administration.
What's that like? Wow, that's awesome. Jerry Ford's from my home, so I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So
it's a pretty amazing feeling. And I remember the story my dad tells when he and my mom were invited to the dance after a state dinner, and walks in and turns to my mom and says, "Oh, Shirley, isn't this wonderful? Just you, me, Gerald and Betty, and 800 of our closest friends."
Well, actually, the only time I've been to the White House, Lyndon Johnson was in office.
Mm.
So I think I ought to date you a little.
A little bit.
But I've never been there.
In answer to your question, you know, clearly Obama, I mean, he oversold the damage the sequester would do. Again, on Facebook, I think I put up that oh, gosh, which was it? It was something about, you know, switching over to with the sequester, apparently now we can't afford the extra hour of daylight. We can't afford the extra hour of nighttime. But it just like any time they're talking about, quote unquote, cutting a budget, you know, certainly on the state level, where, in fact, sometimes people do cut budgets because I think 49 out of the 50 states it's mandated by their constitution, but it's always, well, you know, we're going to have to cut teacher, firemen, and policemen. And it's always made to try and make the cuts as painful as possible so people will relent and vote for higher taxes or vote in people who will vote for higher taxes. And, you know, no one ever comes out and says, my goodness, with these budget cuts, we're going to have to cut 300 faceless bureaucrats who are at the top of the list when in a snow emergency and we say non-essential personnel don't come in, they're who we're talking about. So with the closing the White House, closing national parks, all this kind of stuff, they're trying to make the sequester as painful and as blatant as possible. But, of course, the sequester is not actually cutting spending. It's only cutting the rate of growth in spending.
And it's also working on a previous budget, not the current budget. Yeah, they also released all those illegal aliens. Now, they're saying, oh, they're innocent people. But first off, they're illegal. They are here illegally. You arrested them for a reason because something occurred that brought them into your attention. Either they were speeding or driving without a license or beating up their girlfriend. They were still in jail, even though they haven't been convicted of anything yet. They're still here illegally, and then you release them. And then they blame it on sequestration. Then they were talking about feeding school kids. That was one of the things. Another one was 100,000 homeless that was going to end up on the street because of sequestration. Yet they've got four calligraphers that combined earn more than – one of them earns like $100,000. Four calligraphers in the White House?
Well, they were also going to pull the plug on some people on respirators. Just yank them right off the wall. They can't afford the
–
no, it never fails.
Fails. Mike, that's the death panels in Obamacare.
That's probably – but, you know, you bring up such a great point. This is government in its finest hour with police and fire and grandma. I think I've brought this up before. But they always say, well, you know, if some thugs break into grandma's house and we're short-staffed on police, we might not be able to save her. And incidentally, while they beat her and rape her and gag her and set her house on fire, because of the police fire cuts, we may not have enough firemen to go there and save the house.
But they won't let you have a gun.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, once again, same old school closings. It never ends. I mean, just the same, as you said, it's always police and fire. Teachers.
Right.
It's just what directly impacts you.
Right. One of the, you know, and one of the things, I think I used to have this on my Twitter profile, and one of the problems that Republicans and conservatives have on selling smaller government and selling fiscal sanity is that the benefits of government are seen, but the costs of government are generally unseen. I mean, if you tax people $100 million and you use it to hire more policemen or hire more firemen or build a new bridge or improve roads, people look at that and they see all of those benefits. What is unseen is what the $100 million would have created if it was left in the private economy. Now, I'm not saying we don't need police, that we don't need firemen, that we don't need roads and bridges and air traffic controllers, et cetera. I mean, yes, I think, you know, one of the reasons you form government is to do things that individually we can't do. But, there's got to be a limit. Well, there is a limit. And that limit is, I don't think we're really going to fundamentally reform the growth and the size of government, the amount of spending, the amount of debt, until people stop being willing to lend us money. When the decision is made not by Congress, but it's made by the International Monetary Fund or other buyers of our debt. And I think one of the things people, and this is an important point, because people will throw it in your face. It's like, well, you know, if we're so in debt and our situation is so bad, why are interest rates so low? Why are people still willing to buy $1 trillion a year in new debt from us? They're not. China, over the last 3 or 4 years, has actually reduced its holdings of our debt, and 75% to 80% of all new debt is being bought by the Federal Reserve as part of their quantitative easing, and I don't even know what number they're up to now. So we're buying our own debt using basically funny money, you know, just accounting gimmicks. And I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, I used to be a bond trader, specifically government and mortgage-backed securities. And if interest rates go back to just historical norms, the cost of servicing our debt is going to increase by about $500 billion a year, or roughly a third of our discretionary spending. And the Federal Reserve now owns well over $3 trillion in long-term government securities. If long-term interest rates go from 3% to 6%, the value of those securities that they own drops roughly in half, or $1.5 trillion loss. And if they start selling into the market to reduce that risk, they're selling into a market that's already falling, which means interest rates are going to increase further. I mean, the Federal Reserve right now is the, if any of your listeners are old enough to remember the savings and loan crisis, where short-term interest rates skyrocketed and they had all these long-term mortgages and they were losing money hand over fist. The coming crisis, when interest rates start going up and the Fed, is going to make the savings and loan crisis look like a cakewalk.
Wow. And we've already got a record number of unemployment right now. So you would see something akin to the Black Friday crash.
Yeah, actually, I was working on Wall Street the day of the crash, and we were, and it was kind of interesting that, you know, we were watching. It's like, okay, Dow's down 200, Dow's down 300, Dow's down 400, and those numbers don't sound big now with the Dow at 14,005, but those were big numbers back then when the Dow, I think, was only at about 1,500, and we're talking about losing 30% of the value of the Dow in a day. But what was interesting, I finally started looking over at my bond screens, and the price of government bonds were just skyrocketing. So, but no, it's as I posted recently, describing what's going on at the Fed, just from a position basis, it's like, this is not going to end well.
No, no.
The day you're referring to, is that with George Herbert Walker Bush? Was he president then, or was are you talking about when it went down so many hundred, or was that under George W. Bush?
No, this was the original one back in 87.
Okay, all right, I remember. Before you go, I know you got to rush. Any political runs in their future endeavors?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? You cut out for just a second.
Any potential run for Congress or back to state senate or no state representative or anything along those lines for us?
Well, certainly not from me. We're in the thick of political things here in Massachusetts. We have the election, special election to replace John Horseface Kerry. We have three candidates on the Republican side. Former U.S. Attorney Mike Sullivan, former Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez, my personal favorite. He's a state rep. He was Mitt Romney's legal counsel. He was a judge. He's one of those guys that could walk into Foxborough Gillette Stadium on a Sunday afternoon and still be reasonably confident that he's the smartest guy in the room. And this is a guy named Dan Winslow. And he's going to be one of those three will be taking on. It looks like the Democratic nominee is going to be current Congressman Ed Markey. And personally, whoever wins from the Republican side, I think runs on a platform of, you know, vote for blah, 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 because we already have one moon bat in the Senate from Massachusetts.
Oh, my God. It's just never an end with the liberal Massachusetts. I mean, it's like each candidate's more liberal than the last.
That's why I didn't end up living up there. But people can find you, Brad, up in Facebook, Twitter. You're on Four-Tier Strategy. They can go to that also to find your links. And you're also on Rebel Mouse.
Right. I'm over my friend limit on Facebook, but I do have a page. People can subscribe to my news stream on my regular profile on Twitter. I'm just at Brad Marston, if you really want to get some good laughs and get some good insights, I would strongly recommend people follow my business partner at JSL Consulting, John LaRosa. I find myself retweeting him all the time.
I didn't have the luxury of being one of your Facebook friends, so I just like your fan page. I must not fit in that elite group. So,
well, you remember, I ran for state rep, and that's when I really grew my friend base. I used, getting back to what I do for a living, which is advise campaigns and primarily in the area of social media and online fundraising. You know, here I am running in a little state rep race, first time candidate in an impossible district. And I raised money from 26 states. I went from maybe having 1,000 friends to over 4,000 friends. So, you know, it works. And I had volunteers in other states. I mean, I would send them a Google spreadsheet with a list of names and phone numbers. People phone banking for me in Arizona, down in Texas, a couple down in Alabama. I'm not sure Bostonians could really understand what they were saying, but at least they were making the phone calls.
That's terrific. That's terrific. You know, it does prove that conservatives out there are willing to go to reach out wherever to help fellow conservatives.
Absolutely.
Now, Brad, the most important question of the day before you fly, how are the Red Sox going to be this year?
I think they're going to be much better than last year. Are they going to necessarily contend for the pennant? Not sure about that. Major League Baseball is getting a little bit like the old NHL, where they played 82 games to eliminate the Hartford Whalers from the playoffs. It all comes down to pitching, and some of our starting pitching is looking pretty good. We just got the word that they're shutting down David Ortiz for probably 3 or 4 weeks, so he won't be in the lineup, and that really hurts us statistically. But I'm like almost every Boston Red Sox fan. You start cautiously optimistic. I always used to describe the Red Sox sort of like lawn furniture. You know, you bring them out in the spring, and it's all shiny and nice. And by August it starts to fade, and then in September you put it away for storage and wait until next year
and buy a new set.
well put it. If ever I get to Boston, my friend, you and I are we're going to catch a game or do something.
Terrific. Oh, one other thing. If any of you folks are going to be at CPAC, please look for John and I. You can go to our website, fourtierstrategies.com, and there's a link at the top labeled Unsustainable Bar Tab, and that is the party that we throw in our suite every year at CPAC, and would love to love a chance to meet people.
Yeah, you have an invite up there, so anyone is at CPAC, they can sign up and become part of the invite. We're going to have a floor reporter. Justin Kendall is going to be on CPAC floor Friday, but at the same time, we're having 10 of the 16 Republican candidates for Tim Scott's seat here on air live in a special three-hour edition.
Oh, that's great. And actually, what is it? Thursday night, Four Tier is sponsoring a party called By Invitation Only, and all the proceeds of that goes to the American Conservative Union Scholarship Fund that allows college kids that wouldn't be able to afford to attend CPAC to come. So, I don't know, I think it's maybe $50 to get in, but none of that money comes to us. All the proceeds go to the scholarship fund.
Awesome. Brad, you have been a fantastic guest, and you are most definitely welcome back anytime.
Terrific. Annie, Mike, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, my friend. We will be in touch. Wow.
All right.
Brad,
bye-bye.
Marston. Brad Marston, Republican for president in 2016, everybody. Just. Oh, boy.
We had such fantastic guests.
Oh, it was. And, you know, and Annie, I think the best thing about today, not only was Brad a great guest, I mean, how, in many ways, how can you not be looking so forward to Friday's show? But he just kind of took our mind right off it.
Oh, man. Yeah, and Friday is going to be a quite a coordination. We're going to have all 10 on at the same time.
Wow. That is going to be absolutely. And for those who don't know, Annie and I are talking off the air to coordinate all this. This is fun. This is almost like this is really amazing. This is going to be a great night. You know, and I'm telling everyone, not only on my Facebook, but also the other Facebook parties, tea parties and other parties. And
yeah,
wow.
My cell phone has been going nonstop now for the last several days. And quite honestly, for 2 days straight, I had the flu. So trying to talk on the phone and with these guys, it was a bit of a challenge. But we got to coordinate. So we've got 10 of the 16. There's a possibility that we may have another two popping in. We've got that conference call with their staff on Thursday, just so everything coordinates nicely. But we'll have our call-in lines. So you guys out there can call in and ask any one of the candidates questions or post them in the chat room. We're going to have a phenomenal show.
Yeah, it's going to be so, so exciting. I mean, I had actually, and I'll be talking about this on Conservative Primetime. I just think this is the biggest home run I've ever seen. Wow. I mean,
yeah.
Last week when we had the guests on, yeah, it was last week. I thought walking away, that is the best BTR show I've ever in my life been a part of, ever. I mean, I've been doing,
yeah.
And I think this one is, you're almost so excited because you know this one has the potential of being just, Annie, I don't know how the hell you did this. I mean, this is like, wow, lady, this is a grand slam home run on top of starring in a porn with Jenna Jameson. Well, okay, wait a minute, let me retract that. That didn't fit in real well. But
No, it didn't. Someone asked about what's the scoop on the show. What I put up in the chat room is the link to my personal tea party. And on the home page, there's a scorecard that has scores of all 16 candidates, 5 being the highest, 1 being the lowest. So you can see where each one of the candidates stand. There's also on the page a bio of each one of the candidates. And if you go to our Friday show page, we've got 10 of them. We've got Rick Bryant, Keith Blanford, Larry Grooms, who is a state representative, Elizabeth Moffley, who works for the Charleston, who is on the Charleston School Board, Ray Nash, who is a sheriff up in Dorchester. He was the one that announced his candidacy while he was still in charge of training the Afghan police at their embassy in Afghanistan, Kabul. Andy Patrick is a state representative, former Secret Service. Teddy Turner Jr., son of Ted Turner, yes, that annoying liberal, Jeff King, and then we also got John Hoffman that just joined. John also military background and government service. So it's going to be really very, very interesting, all 10 of them. I would say out of here, you've got 1, 2, 3, possibly 4 solid candidates that would be true conservatives. The others will in places in between to complete rhino. And I want you guys to tune in and figure out which one.
Well, on top of that, Annie, the election is basically Tuesday, correct?
The election, yeah, is the following the weekend. It's that Tuesday, the 19th.
And you yourself will be voting in this, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, that's amazing.
My polling location exactly 1 mile away from where I am right now. So I will be voting prior. So that way, whatever they say is not going to influence me, or I pretty much know which way I want to go. Or maybe I should vote afterwards. What do you think?
I think we all have an open mind, but obviously, clearly, there's a little bit of extra love for one of those candidates. But you know what? Hey, I mean, that's part of being a candidate. Part of when we do the Playboy Energy contest is we hand people ballots. You actually see boyfriends voting for other girls because during the contest, other girls have kind of swayed their vote. So it's politics. So, you know, having these candidates who Annie has a preference, by the end of it, Annie is now thinking, you know, that person B and person C really sounded well. And from Friday's show, who really didn't do well? I mean, it seemed like all those candidates were on true conservative values. And I even have to take my hat off to, I forgot her name, the lady who talked
Elizabeth
about...
Elizabeth Mockley.
Yeah, she basically talked about when it comes to conservatives, the females in Congress are pretty much the female Republicans are the ones holding guns. They're not budging, but it's the guys that are wishy-washy. So, I mean, she brought up good points, but it's all about, you know, part of that is letting them sell themselves. And, you know, we're all human beings. We're all a little biased on something. I mean, whether it's a food we eat, a restaurant we're at, politics, you know, a particular beverage, we all have biasness in us. So, I mean, it's up to a person to be a salesman and to sell you on that. All these candidates, this is going to be, man, oh, man, I'm waiting for one of these fights to break out thinking, how are we going to handle this one? You'll be, I'll be like, I'll be messaging you, Annie, let it go. And you'll be like, no, come on. I'll be like, well, candidate A, you know, candidate C private messaged me and said this about you. And, you know, I want to kind of not change subjects, Annie, but I want to say something is that I think you asked the one candidate a very question about his previous indiscretions. I don't think a lot of people would ask that question. I think because they're too nervous, they're too scared, and you challenged them. How is it people are supposed to trust you, you being one of them, when you, previous discretions? And I think part of that is asking the questions that, you know, there's a moment of pause after the question is asked. And then there's the wait to see what kind of response they get. You won't see that on a lot of shows, period. You just won't. They just don't want to talk about it.
Which you get a lot of times when these candidates go on other shows, the staffers reach out to them ahead of time, like, what question is he going to ask? What are you going to do? How are you going to ask them? What's the format? And this is why I've been fielding phone calls nonstop, because these staffers want to know what they're sending their candidate into. And I'm not telling them any question we're asking. All I'm telling them, it's going to be a forum format. We're going to be asking questions directly to the candidates, and it may be the same question to two candidates, or I may have one candidate say something, and if it deserves a rebuttal from another candidate, I may bring that person on. They have no idea what is coming from them. And honestly, at this point, I have no idea what is going to be coming at them because I haven't even written the questions yet. I'm sure, Mike, you haven't put any together yet. But the best part is we're going to have people calling in and asking the candidates questions directly, and we're going to have the chat room open. So anyone that wants to ask a question in the chat room can post it there. And if we have enough time, we'll try to get all the questions in as much as possible. We're going from 90 minutes to a full 3 hours.
That's amazing. I mean, we are just the pre-meeting for this for us once we're done talking to all the candidates. The post after that, oh, my God, you and I will probably be scrambling. Oh, my God, this is awesome. This is just what it's all about. I mean, and everyone, you know, if you feel like it, post a question early, maybe write Annie, or, wow, this is just too exciting.
They can send me a message through our website, which is southernsense.webs, WEBS.com. I'm going to put that up in the chat room right now because there is a email link in there that they can ask a question ahead of time if they don't feel like being in the chat room or feel they're not going to be able to get online. Post it here. Southern Sense, with this extra dot in there.
Did you see what Bloom wrote? She wrote Ted Turner Jr. She said one Turner's enough.
Let me correct that. All right, I want to remind everyone also that we've got Lieutenant Dan Band coming back here to Beaufort, South Carolina. And if anyone wants information on Lieutenant Dan Band, if they want to come to beautiful sunny South Carolina and see Garrison Easy's band, LDW4. Tickets are on sale, $25. Come June 1st, they're going to shoot up. So if you want to get your tickets, get them now. And you can also email me, and I'll tell you the best places to stay, eat, drink, have fun. Okay? So,
yeah.
Mike, we had a rocking show.
We certainly did, and we're going to have another one on Friday. Everyone, I'm sure we'll be talking more and more on it, but I'm excited for Friday. Wow.
Yeah, everyone have a very, very healthy and happy week, and we'll see you back here on Friday, same bat time, same bat station at 2 o'clock for a special 3-hour edition of Southern Sense. Until then,
good afternoon, everybody.
Good night, and God bless, and thank you for participating.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.
American.